And what is happening? Welcome back to the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm your host, Yogi Roth, and I want to say thanks for all the love and reviews. Fired up. We are on new and noteworthy on iTunes. It has been a blast. We have really gotten some really cool notes from all of you. Today's guest, I'm stoked about because this is an awesome week. This is the week leading up to what is known in high school football as the opening. It's where the top high school football players in the entire country meet to compete. They show up on Nike's campus after a variety of regional camps around the country seeking the top players, which include, of course, the quarterbacks. That means the Elite 11 competition continues. We've already had the Elite 11 finals. You're going to see part one of that documentary July 1st on Bleacher Report. It will continue to release throughout the week. From July 1st to July 10th, you're going to be able to watch a variety of fun episodes. You're going to love it. Our team that did it is epic. But we would not have the Elite 11 documentary. We wouldn't probably have the efficiency within the Elite 11 and the opening if it wasn't for today's guest. It is Brian Stump. He's the president of Student Sports. Student Sports, they organize all these camps around the country. It's been going on for 18 years. Brian has been there for 17 of them. But he has an amazing story. And every high school athlete, they know Brian because you have to email him to get invited to one of the camps to get evaluated, and then eventually if you compete and you succeed and you thrive in these settings, you get invited to the opening. So I wanted to make sure that we talked Elite 11, talked about the opening with a guy who's in charge of organizing all of it, among the many amazing members of his team. What's incredible about Brian is that he's known as this guy in the high school space, but like all of us, right, he's got this epic story, and I wanted to dive into it. You know, I've worked with Brian for this is my eighth season now with the Elite 11, but I've known him since I moved to LA 12 years ago. He's a savant. You know, he is best in class. And when you learn in this podcast, you get to learn about his photographic memory. You get to learn about his path from a small, tiny town, which I loved relating to, and I think many of you will as well, to getting a full scholarship to play wide at Cal, which, by the way, a lot of members of his family went there, his mom, his dad, his grandparents. He just had this lineage at Cal, so we hear about that. And he also goes into how his career was cut short and now why he gives back to the game through these camps and what he hopes that the experience that the Elite 11 and the opening and all the regional camps provide for a variety of student-athletes as they are the next generation of leaders in a lot of departments. So I think you're going to enjoy it. Brian is a guy, as I said, I've known for a long time, but didn't know the depth or the breadth of his story, and I was really intrigued by it. And now it's the week of the opening. It's the week of the Elite 11. We are going to be on our way starting July 5th on Nike's campus, and the competition will be on. And like I said, episode one of the Elite 11 documentary will air July 1st on Bleacher Report. We'll make sure we kick out that link. But without further ado, let's bring in the man who has an epic story. He's influencing thousands of athletes. He's been doing it for over 17 years, Brian Stump. Let's welcome in for the first time into the grand studio in the kitchen, Brian Stump. B, what's up, man?
I'm doing great. This is going to be fun. My first podcast experience, so be gentle with me. Take it easy. ease me in. But no, fired up to do this and wrap with you. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, no, it's awesome, man. It's been a great experience for me, and I basically have one rule, and I try to ask questions I don't know the answer to. And I know you on a lot of levels, from football, documentaries, going to camps all across the country, but there's a lot of things I don't know. So it was fun preparing. You're trying to look at my questions now. You can't go there. But it's my favorite part about this entire podcast. So the first question I'd like to start off with is, what's your recollection of how we met? And then I'll tell mine.
Ooh, that's a good one. I'm going to go back. You said 8 years, so I'm going to speculate it's right around then. I want to say it was probably around one of the regionals in Los Angeles, introduced through, the man who knows everybody who could run for political office in Southern California and definitely in the South Bay, my boss for, my 17 years at Student Sports, Andy Bark, who connected us. But around that, you know, my recollection is pretty fuzzy. The problem I have a photographic memory, so when I see names on paper and it's associated or names in an email and then I see the face, I can keep it. But when I'm out at camps and I get introduced to 97 new people at each camp, or a high school coach that's been volunteering for 3 or 4 years comes up and says hi, if I don't have a name to associate it with it, it doesn't stick with me for a while. So you might have a better recollection of that experience than than me. But I'm going to go with it was at SC at a regional camp.
Well, my memory is when USC, back in the day when I was coaching there, we had a pro day that still goes down as like the greatest pro day in the history of pro days. And just to set the stage, it's Reggie Bush, reigning Heisman winner. Matt Leinart, 2 years earlier, was the Heisman Trophy winner. Lendale White. A cast, I think, of Dwayne Jarrett. I mean, it was a no. I don't know if Dwayne came out that year, but it was a cast of players.
Like, and the linebackers, is that Clay and Kush and year or year after Ray? Yep.
It was epic. And at SC, we had this track, and they still have this track where you have maybe 10,000 seats, and the pro days were open to the public. And of course, the way Coach Carroll did it, he opened it up. You guys ran it. Spark was huge then. And I remember watching you operate, and I was like, man, these guys are flawless. And I knew Andy because I got to know him and his son. They'd always be around the program. But I was always like, man, that's Brian. And we never really connected a lot that day. I was just kind of the slappy running around, probably carrying somebody's water jug. But I do recall that. But I want to dive into what you described as a photographic memory. When did you recognize you had that? And how does that even occur?
That's a great question. I think my first probably awareness of it was when I was coming up through grade school, and I was really good with numbers. So, like, you remember back doing your times tables in second or third grade, and, you know, your teacher would give you the paper, and it was kind of everybody's working on it at the same time, and you drop your pencil and kind of see who finished first. That was my first recollection or awareness of I might have a different ability, and it wasn't, you know, I'm good with numbers and that sort of stuff, but I think it was more of even a memorization type of thing, and being able to see those numbers on paper and then stick in my head for whatever reason it is, I don't know. But yeah, names, I think as I came up also through grade school and that sort of stuff, started to read a lot, and I grew up without cable television and a home computer and things like that, so I would read even encyclopedias sometimes. It was where I grew up, it was cold and rainy a lot. So we'd go outside, but a lot of times you were stuck inside. So I'd read encyclopedias, I'd read sports history, trivia, that sort of stuff, watch Jeopardy with my dad. So a lot of stuff just stuck in my head for whatever reason. Photographic memory, it's a cool thing to have, and it applies really well to this line of work in terms of being able to remember names and history and facts around events and football specifically. But probably growing up, you know, and going through those times tests in second grade and dropping the pencil and looking around and everybody's still working on it, be like, hey, I might be all right at this sort of stuff. So that's where I think I first kind of picked up on it.
When did you have your first conversation about it? Was it like, hey, Mom, like, math's really easy to me, or your parents being like, I think our son can, you know, he's got this photographic memory.
You know, it was probably when I got older. My dad is a extremely intelligent guy. He graduated first in his class at Cal Berkeley and won the presidential medal there. So he's a genius. So I have two really smart parents, and I think their expectations, and they said it when I was growing up with my brother and my sister too, you know, school is something that we're trying to excel at. You know, we're not just there to get C's and B's and that sort of stuff. So always did well in school. The memory thing though, yeah, it was probably more around the numbers, more around than football statistics and things like that. And, you know, watched a lot of that with my dad, growing up on TV whenever we could. And then I know, cause I peeked at your notes, I know you got it in there that, a lot of time we spent, my dad and I was driving back and forth to Cal games when I was a kid. It was a 5-hour drive. So we'd talk a lot and read a lot and numbers. And it definitely came up in those conversations as it relates to being able to recite stuff back and ask questions to each other and, you know, talk about the game too, you know, that we just went to and kind of recap it as we drove back up home, 5 hours, middle of the night, getting back to sleep in our beds on a Saturday night after a day game at Cal. So, probably when I was 12, 13 is when you kind of started to realize that, you know, the numbers stick in my head probably a little bit more than other kids.
Wow. That's fascinating to me because I've heard that a lot. Like Trent said that to me. He's like, you know, Brian has photographic memory and you have this crazy memory. And as the president of student sports, which is Elite 11, Nike football training camps, and a bunch of a variety of other different sports, your memory is probably expanding because you're seeing names and numbers and colleges and high schools all the time. But what's that like as a kid? Okay, so you're 12, 13. You're having these super high-level convos with Dad on the way back from Cal games. But what's it like when you walk into, like, English class or math class or recess or, you know, the junior high dance?
Yeah, I think when I was growing up, and it's I think every kid when they're in junior high, they have that kind of that social anxiety where you want to balance being cool with doing well in school. And so for me, I always did well in school, and I was, you know, if the teacher asked a question, you know, I would be ready to raise my hand if it was an open-ended question for anybody to jump in with. So, I think I felt it a little bit in junior high. I was intelligent and, you know, not nerdy. I tried to balance it with sports and socially and that sort of stuff. But at the same time, I did enjoy, you know, we had a math team competition, and we went to things like that and competed. And again, it goes back to competition. So I embraced it in terms of trying to take it to the highest level, whether it's math or whether it's sports, and doing well in school. And you just try and balance it. But it's nothing I would ever complain about. And it's helped me, I guess, as it relates to being able to excel at this line of work and keep things in your memory breaks as it relates to history of the events or kids that have come through it and projecting guys to the next level and being able to try and recall as much of that information as you can.
So this is the week of the opening, which is basically, you know, football heaven. If you're a high school football player, top players in the country at every position are going to show up, including the Elite 11 quarterbacks. You're around this demo of student athletes a lot. Wondering what you were like then. You know, did you fall in love with the game? And you always give these great speeches at the beginning of every camp about what it means to compete, you know, what it means to be a good teammate, what it means to respect people around you. Are you talking to the younger version of Brian Stumpf at all? Or what type of guy were you, and when did you fall in love with the game so much so that you knew you wanted to play in college?
Yeah, so great question. I'm definitely talking to myself when I was 17 or 18, because I wish I knew then what I knew now. I think growing up, I was in a small town. You were able to play every sport at high school if you wanted to, and you were talented enough. So I didn't. When I got to college, I wasn't ready for the focus on solely football and year-round training, and it wasn't anything I even knew existed. I wasn't prepared for it. And it took me a while to adjust to that. Like, when football season was done, I wanted to go play basketball. Like, right. That's what I did growing up. I loved basketball. I loved football. I loved, you know, baseball. I ran track. So that was an adjustment for me. And by the time I realized the commitment that was needed to continue to excel at that level, I was injured. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, my playing career was done. But yeah, I'm absolutely talking to the 17-year-old version of me that probably loved the game at that point more for what it did for me than what I could do for it. I loved competing, obviously, but I didn't embrace when I was in high school the lonely lurk. I really didn't know what it was, because I didn't need to put in that level of commitment at that time to excel. So for me to be able to go through this and be around all the coaches, and, you know, the coaches I was experienced and exposed to in college taught me a lot, and then being in this line of work and going on the Nike tours every year and being around the great people that, you know, Andy at first assembled when I was just starting and being exposed to those folks, and then now growing into the role of leading the tours. You can walk around at any camp and learn from all the guys we have out there on the field working with the high school kids. So I'm still doing that every day. But yeah, I absolutely wish I could, you know, go back in that time machine and, you know at 17 what I now know at 39. Things might have been different.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But here's my question, though. You talked about how you didn't know about the lonely work, right? And the lonely work we describe as grit, for those of you that haven't heard the phrase before, doing the boring things longer than other things. You see these freak athletes every weekend across the country, in football specifically, throughout the offseason. We can tell them about the lonely work. We can teach them about it, but they're still 16, 17 years old. What have you seen from you and your team exposing these student athletes to those types of conversations, the growth that you were not, you know, you didn't get exposed to at that age? Because they're still 16, right? But you're talking a different language to them. And I'd imagine you'd see them taking it in and really growing.
Yeah, I think the pleasure and the pain of doing this job is you do see kids latch on to what you're saying and grow from it and apply it and go on to be successful guys, whether it's, you know, one of my favorites is a guy like Chase Daniel, who was never the most naturally talented kid, but he whether he was born with it, whether he learned it through high school, you know, hopefully we helped him along that road. And then when he got to college, but he embraced everything we're talking about in terms of being a leader, being an influencer, being a guy that all other 84 guys on scholarship at Missouri absolutely loved and would go to battle with every weekend, and same thing in the pros now in NFL with, you know, everybody on that roster loves Chase Daniel. There's no question about it. So you see that those guys that learn and apply it, but also you see, you know, unfortunately you can't get through to every kid. So we have kids come through the events every year, and we try to connect with them all, and we try to provide great voices and different voices, because, you know, my voice might resonate with 2 kids out of 10, and yours might hit another 2 kids, and Trent might hit 3 or 4. And but it's different strokes for different folks. So it is tough when you see a kid come through that has all the talent and ability in the world to take football a long way, in this case of this sport, and also, you know, potentially provide a better life for his future family. But, you know, they're 18, and sometimes you can't get through to them, and there's more important things like, you know, going out with the dudes and doing stuff that can potentially derail their current college football career and that sort of stuff. So when you see a guy that came to the opening 3 years ago and he gets in trouble and, you know, he's not playing ball anymore because of things that he could have controlled, that's tough. But that's the reality of what we do. It's the reality of, you know, teachers in school, and other people that are trying to be influencers and facilitators. You try to improve your message every year so you can improve that percentage of people you're connecting with and getting through and helping improve their situation, hopefully. So
you alluded to an injury when you were in college. So you go to college. Brian comes from a tiny town. How many people are in your town? How many people did you graduate with?
There were 160 kids in my high school class. Okay. So probably a little under 800 total at our high school.
And you don't get recruited really till your senior year, right? Because that's when you ball out. And back in the day, the numbers that I found, you had 58 grabs, 1,039 yards, 8 touchdowns in 9 games as a senior. Pretty impressive. Back in the day, probably weren't throwing the ball over the yard like they are now. What was it like, A, getting an opportunity to play major college football, and then having that taken away, and what happened with your injury?
So high school, played football like 6th, 7th, 8th grade, Pop Warner, baller, whatever, you know.
Of course, yeah.
Championships, all that good stuff. Come in freshman year, I was a running back. I was 5'8", 5'9", maybe 140, and broke my tib fib like 2nd week of training camp in high school. We had a small group, so we were practicing up with varsity guys and all that sort of stuff. And at that point, I loved football. I still followed football. I still went to Cal games, but I was done playing football. I didn't play my sophomore year. Basketball was my favorite sport. So basketball was up on varsity as a sophomore and doing all that sort of stuff. And then I started running track. And junior year, track won the 100 and 200 meter up in our little dual county area behind the Redwood Curtain. So the football coach came to me after, you know, after the spring wraps up and junior year high school is done, and said, hey, we're gonna throw the ball around next year. Our high school team was 0-9 my junior year, and we got a decent young quarterback, so we're gonna try and do some run and shoot and put some 4-wide stuff in, and love for you to play football. You know, you do what you want to do. I was more concerned probably about not getting injured and being healthy for basketball, because I had grades, and I think in my mind I was thinking I was going to go play hoop somewhere at, you know, UCSB or Ivy League or somewhere like that, and have fun in college and do that sort of stuff. But yeah, went out and played football my senior year. I'm a decent sized guy. You can't tell on the podcast, but I'm probably 6'2.5". I was still skinny. I was a buck 60, buck 65, but I could run for kids up there. And I did know the game. You know, I wasn't coming in as a kid that had never played football or followed football and just was a track guy. So it was, you know, I don't want to say it was easy, but it came pretty naturally, and had a good season. And recruiting was different then. You know, there wasn't the internet, and there weren't star rankings, and, you know, summer camps at schools were sort of a big deal, but there was still a lot of recruiting that went on just during people's senior year. So was able to send out my highlight tape that me and my buddies put together. We had a multimedia class at our high school that was pretty good. So we cut the tape and sent out a couple copies, sent some sweet VHSs out to UW and Oregon and Cal and Stanford. It probably went the furthest with Cal and Oregon, took a visit to Cal. They offered me on my visit a week before signing day. I committed to Coach Keith Gilbertson. And then when I got back, Oregon called. There was a great receiver at De La Salle named Mike Bastianelli, who was down to USC, Oregon, and Cal, and he committed to USC that weekend. So basically, Cal and Oregon both moved on me as soon as he made his decision. So Oregon offered me; they wanted me to come visit too. I remember the conversation with Coach Bilotti pretty well because it was probably the first time I got ripped by anybody on the phone.
No way. What did he say?
So when I said, hey, you know, I gave my word and I'm going to Cal, and, you know, he just kind of went on the rant of, hey, you know, they got 12 guys on scholarship already. We only have six. You know, you're making a terrible mistake and blah, blah, blah. And you know, in retrospect, if playing time was the only thing that was important to me, he might have been right. But I did have a deep history and an appreciation for University of California. Both my parents went there. I grew up around it, even though I live 5 hours away, and I did value the education and the degree and what would come along with it. So, didn't take the trip, signed with Cal and got there again at about 165 pounds and, was super self-conscious about my body in terms of, you know, how big the other guys were. And I had never lifted weights before. I was a 3-4 sport athlete in high school, and, you know, I didn't lift during basketball season because it messed up my shot. So when I got there, it was definitely a transition. It was an experience in terms of what I talked about earlier, just learning that the year-round commitment that it was going to be. I don't think I was prepared for that. We redshirted our whole class except for one guy. Keith Gilbertson was the coach. He got fired. And Steve Mariucci came in December of our freshman year. And that's when I think everything changed for the kids in our class. I think we were re-energized by this coach. I remember calling my dad and saying after our first meeting with him, like, we're going to win two more games next year just because our coach and the staff he's going to bring in. It was a different feel, a different organization, new strength coach. I dove in head first in terms of getting in the weight room and trying to get bigger. I think I added 15 pounds or so, still a deep receiver group. So my redshirt year, obviously scout team, my freshman year, still scout team. We had Bobby Shaw, Damian Douglas, Nile Benjamin, Tony Gonzalez was the tight end, and a lot of great talent. And Coach Mariucci also ran practice more in an NFL style. So there were four guys getting reps with the ones and another two guys that were up on the twos, and everybody else was running scout team still. So tough year from the standpoint that I knew I had made gains and was committed to it now, and I kind of understood what it took, but was buried. Mariucci, great year for Cal standards. We went 6-5 and lost in a bowl game, and he got hired by the 49ers. So Tom Homo was the defensive coordinator. He got the job. Most of the staff stayed on. I continued to work as best I could. I think I was up to 185 or so. And probably had, I think my best camp going into my sophomore year. There were guys that were injured. I was running with the ones and the twos all the camp. Played, you know, as many snaps as anybody in the last scrimmage before the first game, and travel roster goes up for the first game at Houston, and I'm not on it. So that was really tough for me. I think the next couple weeks after that, I kind of fully realized that I embraced being part of the team and what my role was. If it was scout team, great. Halfway through the season, we were having a tough game. Coach Homo was in a team meeting and, you know, kind of stress that, you know, we need guys to buy into being a team. So I'm a quiet guy. I don't really put myself out there too much. And I took it upon myself to go into his office that week and say, hey, coach, I just wanted to let you know, because you didn't recruit me and all you've seen is me is running scout team. Probably don't watch that much. But whatever you guys need, I'm here. You know, if it's special teams, I wasn't the biggest guy. I wasn't the most physical guy. But I'll run down and run through a wall. I'll do whatever you guys want me to do. And so that week, I want to say it was the fourth or fifth game, they put me on kickoff cover and kickoff return, and I was twos on punt return and the other special team. So finally got to play. Like, it was awesome. It was a dream in terms of my family and growing up and going to games when I was a kid, and finally being able to get on the field and not just be a practice guy. So played special teams the rest of that year, did some good things, did some not so good things, did some all right things, but stayed on the teams and all that sort of stuff. And really felt good about, you know, having a role on the team and a lot of pride and getting out there finally. And so that off season was good. Just continuing to get bigger, doing a lot of good things in the weight room. I think I had the, you know, fourth or fifth highest vertical jump in the history of the receivers in the program. I was up over 36 that offseason and could do some things. And that spring, fractured my hip, dislocated.
So it's a practice?
Ball. Yeah, in spring ball. Ball and socket joint dislocation. So the outside of the socket, there's fractures. And after that, it was really tough. It was a unusual injury. They didn't really have a lot of case studies to go off of and that sort of stuff. So it was really trial and error in terms of how they handled it and the process to rehab and get healthy. But basically missed the whole next year. It was a long process just feeling comfortable with it and coming back and was able to get back out on the field for a little bit heading into my senior year. And it dislocated again in fall camp that year. And I was done after that. So it was tough in terms of, I think I finally realized what it took to make it and the work I needed to put in. And right about that time, you know, I had 6 months or so when I really kind of started clicking in my head. And right about that time is when I got hurt, and rehabbing was tough. And I never really felt confident in what I was doing in the rehab and getting back out there, like I was going to be myself again, which made it tough too. But the positives were that I learned so much being in the locker room with different guys. You know, I grew up in a small town and wasn't exposed to a ton, to be perfectly honest. So met a lot of new guys, met a lot of great guys. And then being on that campus, you get exposed to peoples of all nationalities and ethnic backgrounds and worldly people and worldly thinkers. Three different coaching staffs, five different receiver coaches in 5 years. So we saw, I mean, the full gamut of personalities. And I think the things you learn through being on a football team and being in a locker room and persevering through, you know, challenges and things like that, whether it's injury or losing or guys leaving the program and coming in. And it was an incredible experience from that point. I went to a great school, but I learned by far more being on a football team for 4.5 years and being in a locker room and learning how to form relationships and deal with people there than I did in any classroom at Cal, which, you know, I don't think it says anything poorly about the school. Right. It's just you've been in it, and a locker room is just a different world. And for me, it was such a great thing to be a part of, coming where I came from and being able to learn as much as I did. So,
wow, you know, man, that's impressive. Yeah. I didn't know any of that other than like high touch points of Steve Mariucci, you know, and your injury. So you've always been a smart guy, right? 3.95 coming out of high school. I'm assuming you probably had a 4.0 or something close to it in college.
Yeah, like 3.2.
Okay, cool. You had a 3.2, but it's a Cal, so yep. We'll give you a little asterisk there. But you know your career is over, and you're not going to go continue to play. Clearly, you've got the mind to work in finance. You've got the mind to go coach. You've got the mind to become a scout. I mean, there's the sports community. If you wanted to remain in that culture, you could have done it. But you come to work for a company which at the time was the industry leader, student sports in camps around the country. And I went to one of those camps, but it wasn't crushing it, right? It was cool, probably. Founded by, you mentioned earlier, Andy Barker, another Cal alum, former wideout. Why did you take this job? And was it a job where you were like, okay, I'm just going to move to LA and start in the camp business because it's a Cal alum, it'll be cool, but really I want to try to get to, I don't know, Smith Barney or the Cleveland Browns or 49ers. Why did you take it, and what was the vision when you came down to Los Angeles?
So I think one of my strengths and probably my greatest weakness is I'm not really a long-term thinker. So me and my roommate at Cal, Wes Dalton, we set it up so after the 1999 football season, it finished. We had 2 units left to graduate. So we were on scholarship check for another 5 or 6 months. And so we signed up for a pass, not pass history class that was all based on the final. So we moved to Los Angeles. From my perspective, it was,
no way. Hey,
I'd already lived in Northern California. I'd lived in the Bay Area. I wanted to go down and see what LA was like. I knew I wanted to work in sports. Some way it was just my passion. I took a lot of great classes at Cal. I really loved political science. I was a mass comm major. So I wanted to try and get into something in sports media, but really we moved down in January, didn't have a job lined up, but we knew we had our $775 scholarship check coming in until May. So we had a couple months to play with. Found a little apartment right by the Beverly Center, up off of La Cienega and San Vicente.
Right.
So we're kind of right in the middle, and just had some fun with it. I lined up 2 interviews, one with Andy in student sports and the other one at the Fox Sports lot on Pico when they were doing, I don't even remember the name. It was their version of SportsCenter way back in, you know, 2000. So that was a while back. But it was basically like a PA assistant on that show. So interviewed for that. I think they did this sports quiz and they told me I got the highest score in the sports quiz of anybody that's ever interviewed there. So that was great. They offered me a job that started at 18 grand a year, working from like a shift that was like 3 p.m. to 1 a.m., you know, five or six days a week around the production of the show, which would have been really cool. Interviewed with Andy. He offered me 24. So, you know, that was huge. For a young single guy, not really asking his parents for money and not wanting to, you know, I got a scholarship and went to college and never had to live off them for that standpoint. So I wanted to try and keep that going. That was a thing I just wanted to do myself. But student sports was really small. I think he had 13 or 14 people that worked for him at that point. And Fox obviously is a huge, big old company. And I think I just saw, you know, the money definitely did matter. You know, going from, I didn't want to have lunch at fast food for $2.20 burger every day. You know, I could move up a little bit with that money, but I also just saw a small company that was growing. I didn't know a ton about the camp landscape in terms of, I never went to a football camp when I was in high school. I knew they were starting to do a little bit of it. I knew student sports more for the magazine and Cal High Sports and the coverage that they had provided when I was coming up and I was in the magazine when I was in high school and all that good stuff. So I saw a small company. And I met a man that, Andy Bark, that I had watched play football at Cal when I was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old. And so for me, it was a great opportunity to started a small company and work closely with somebody that I saw as, you know, somebody that had done really well for themselves and could be a mentor, had similar life experiences to me, obviously. So I took a job at Student Sports and I started, you know, writing magazine articles and editing photos and just doing whatever they asked me to do. And it kind of grew from there, and it transitioned a lot more from a magazine after a year or two into events, and it's grown to what it is now, which is pretty crazy to think about when I started there in 2000. So
it's crazy. 17 years. Now, if anybody's followed the Elite 11, you've seen Brian's face and you heard his voice, and his is probably the strongest one in terms of evaluating and understanding where these kids come from, and you're the first person that they ever talk to, right? This is the first email they send out goes to you, and we don't need to give away your email address on this because you probably already got 100 emails by the time this thing started. But did you ever want to go and be like, all right, this is cool, but like, I'm talking to these guys, I'm following them in college, then they go to the NFL. I want to go to the NFL. I want to go to college football because I've been in the college football world. We've been around college and the league. You're just as smart or smarter than GMs, directors of scouting, director of football operations, director of recruiting. I mean, has that pull ever been there for you?
Well, thanks for all that. First and foremost, Yogi, appreciate that. For me, I've had opportunities. I had a couple in terms of going back to Cal at different times where that could have been something that I thought about. I did interview at UCLA one time when Durrell was there and Tom Cable, and there was a position there that could have been something that I could have taken if I liked. For me, there's always been a desire to compete. I think that's the one thing in this job. You're not on a team. There's not a necessarily always a win and a loss. The closest we get to the kids, we get to spend a lot of time with them, obviously, at the Elite 11 finals, the opening finals, and get to know them. And then they're gone, which, you know, the coolest part about college football is turning on any game and being able to watch a dude deal that came through something, and you can shoot him a text or DM or whatever after the game and say, man, that was awesome. Love seeing where you're at. Keep it going. But you're not in the building with him every day. So that's one of the things that I think is always in the back of your mind. NFL, yeah, it would be great. That's a different deal. And sure, is it something that would be interest? Can't say it wouldn't be, but I've never had any discussions as it relates to potentially doing that. But college, definitely, it's been just the timing's never been right. I think a couple of the times when I was looking at it, kind of knew that the coach was, you know, heading towards a make or break time, and for me, in terms of the stability of it, it didn't make sense. And now with a family, that obviously changes the equation in terms of being able to pick myself up and move and do all that sort of thing. But absolutely, yeah, it's something that's in the back of your mind. But at the same time, this is a really great thing that we do, and being around the kids for 6 months of the year and then being able to watch them for the other 6 months is something that I think keeps you feeling young. And as I get older and have my old kids, it's still fun to get out on the field and interact with these guys every week when we're out on the road, and then get to know them at a deeper level at the finals. So I think, like I talked about earlier, I don't really have a a long-term vision for myself, other than I know I love what I do right now, and I'm really lucky to have been in this situation and met Andy and been provided the opportunity by him to do what I do and call it a job, I guess, which is funny in itself. But yeah, to answer your question, it's certainly something that I've thought about before and pops into my mind every once in a while now, and there's conversations that go on. But yeah, it's obviously something that I haven't ever jumped on at this point. So
it's crazy to think about. For 17 years, you've been a part of literally all the major steps in the evolution of not only technology and the game of football, but how recruiting goes in the game of football, how exposure happens in the game of football, how social media has dictated how student athletes get exposed, sometimes for the wrong reasons, in the sport of football. And this week, at the end of the week, it is the opening, which is the grandest stage of high school football. It is what every kid dreams of going. And before we dive into the opening, I want to talk about the Elite 11, because the Elite 11 documentary has been airing on Bleacher Report, will continue to air throughout this week. How have you seen the quarterback position? And for those of you who don't know, the Elite 11, think, for lack of a better description, American Idol for high school quarterbacks. You go, Brian, all over the country. You've done it for 17 years, every region, every city, and kids come out for free because of Nike and other sponsors, and they get to go to this camp and show their stuff, and you and Matt James and the Elite 11 staff evaluate it. As you go through this every year, what does it feel like to be like, yep, here's the top 24, here's the top 11 quarterbacks that have gone through the process? Because I think sometimes it's seen from the outsiders as, oh, what do you mean? You just choose the top 11 guys? I can't believe you didn't pick this dude going to this school with these offers. But you have, just like you did as a child with your photographic memory, there's a process that you go through and your staff goes through to pick these kids.
Yeah, it's something that is really evolved into a year-round process. You mentioned the early years. You know, my first year, I was picking up dudes at the airport at the finals and trying to stay out of the way and not get yelled at for anything. So it was a learning experience for me. But I've been around football. I played with some quarterbacks at Cal, you know, that went on to the highest levels. And I'd seen guys, and, you know, I think you know too, as a receiver, there are certain things that we see that are probably different than quarterbacks that played the position, and they have their certain biases that they might enter with based on how they played the position. And I think it's a little different perspective from our side. But yeah, the evolution of it has been incredible. To think back to when I did start, I told my recruiting story of sending out VHS tapes. That's what it was back in the day. So the access to information and the access to film on kids has changed. It's like from the invention of the refrigerator to now, you know, look at all the different kinds of foods we have, and it's been light years. It's like the Stone Age to the modern era in terms of now I can turn on a computer and I might already have, like you said, 100 emails from kids sending in their film, but I can go out and if I see an article about a kid in Missouri that threw for 380 yards last week, I can go find his huddle in 2 seconds and say, wow, this kid's got some ability. Let's make sure we get him in our system and get him camp info for next year and that sort of stuff. So there's more information. It's more probably work on our side than it was a long time ago, where we could, you know, scour some all state lists and small county lists and know that probably encompasses most of the guys. But the hardest part about it is you can't get to every kid. Whether it's, you know, getting them back a professional reply and showing them the courtesy to, you know, get back an answer, whether it's a yes or a no or a maybe. It takes a lot. I mentioned for me, I wasn't a real outgoing guy, and going into the coach's office for me was a big step. I appreciate every high school kid that sacks up and sends an email and says, hey, I want to be a part of this, or hey, please take a look at me. That's not something that's easy for a kid to do, and I know because that's who I was as a kid. So the toughest part for me is trying to get back to all those guys. And then at the same time, when we get to the camp, you know, we only have so many, you know, hours of the day to look at guys and trying to give every kid a fair shot when we do get through the camp. Cause you mentioned it, there's always going to be hindsight. It's 2020. I was talking to somebody last week about the draft and some of the guys that came through, and Paxton Lynch was a guy that we saw at camp and said, hey, this guy's not bad. What's the deal? Why is nobody, you know, he's super skinny and kind of funky, but he can definitely throw it. It's weird that he's in Florida and nobody's gone on him. And so I think as I've gone through it longer, I think we realize, and Matt's great about it too, and Joey, and trust our instincts, and they're generally pretty spot on with the team of guys we have to do it, and following that part. But yeah, there's always going to be guys we miss. But the great thing about the information that we now have the ability to access with Huddle and watching guys tape and the internet, and you know, it's a lot easier research and stuff. I'm sure you mentioned the mystery of me and finding information. You know, back in my, all you got is probably my cow bio from the website in 1999 to go on, and there's not much else. So it's a challenge, but it's also a great thing that we have access to so much more information to go into this process that, again, we're lucky enough to call a job. So
17 years, you're going all across the country, and I've been on a lot of these trips with you. So this is like Tuscaloosa, this is Charlottesville, this is the middle of nowhere. 17 years, you've also evolved as a man, right? You got married, you've got kids. What has it been like, and if you can share with us, one of your favorite memories from being on the road with the Elite 11, with these Nike football training camp?
Yeah. You mentioned evolving. Yeah. When I was younger, I definitely took probably more full advantage of the road and opportunities when we were traveling. I want to say my second year on the tour, guy that used to work with us, Chris Keldorf, played quarterback at North Carolina, all ACC, he'll tell you, Citrus Bowl MVP, he'll tell you. So we had a camp in Rutgers, real super close to New York City. You know, we usually get on the road at 6:30, so we're on site and start to set it up. We got back to the hotel at 6:15, went up, changed clothes, and went straight to the camp after being in New York City all night and kicked ass at the camp and had a great day. And there were some ballers out there at Rutgers that day, and obviously no worse for the wear from my standpoint. I was probably 24 or 25 and could go differently than I can go now at 39. But, I mean, the best part about being on the road is the time you get to spend with the dudes, whether it's the guys we work with or, parents after a camp or rapping with a kid. But you know, just sitting in an airport waiting right. for your flight and being able to tell stories with the people that we work with. And, we probably take ourselves for granted a lot of times, and you know, we're around each other so much, but those times where you actually be able to sit down and just talk, and it's not getting ready for the camp or, you know, busting your tail at the camp and that sort of stuff, but just being able to spend time with those people, and show them that you appreciate them. And, the team that we're on is, you know, we're not, like we talked about earlier, not on a college football team. There's not wins and losses, but we do have a really cool team. And the guys that we get to, guys and gals that are on our team that we get to spend time with on the road is a lot of fun. So it's balancing that with being away from your family, which is now a lot different. It's changed for me in the last 5 years with kids. So traveling is a little bit more of a task than it was before, but it's still something that when you're out there and you're in the moment, it's still a blast, obviously.
Yeah. Well, that's why I asked that question. I mean, obviously I love the anecdote of New York City, and who doesn't love an all nighter, but you know, you talked about missing the team, and I get that as well. You know, when you leave that environment, any athlete will say that they will not remember a play or a snap and maybe one game, and how it ended in a locker room. But you remember the fellas, right? You remember the squad. You remember the team building. You remember the coaching staff, etc. And now in 17 years, you become the head coach. You know, you are the guy in the football division specifically. You're the president of student sports. So in this podcast, we're talking football and Elite 11 and the opening. And you've become that. And you have this staff that when we're talking about the opening now, I don't know the exact number of players, but you also have a staff that makes this thing run flawlessly. And I'd love to get behind the curtain of how do you define the opening for the listeners, and then how do you prepare for that? Because you guys, you don't take many breaks. I mean, your offseason is the actual football season, but you're going every week. So you're going every week, but you also prepare for like football heaven and this epic event known as the opening.
Yeah, the opening has been an evolution, and to explain it in the nutshell, it's really taking what we've built with the Elite 11 over the past 17 years and expanding it to all positions on the field. So let's get not only the best quarterbacks, but let's get the best running backs, let's get the best receivers, O-line, D-line, DBs, linebackers, and bring them together for this just unbelievable experience, both on and off the field. Happens to be at Nike headquarters, which is not a bad thing at all. It's a unique experience. You know, some of the biggest Nike athletes that they sign and play professional sports don't even go up to their campus. So it's a unique opportunity for those kids to look inside the lens of Nike and how they run, and how they do their thing, and what's made them the company that they are. So from the standpoint of how we've constructed it and how it's evolved, this will be the sixth year of the opening. And it's a huge organism that's always moving and growing. And but the cool thing about it is the guys that we get to come up and work it, you know, whether it's a Willie McGinnis working with the linebackers or LaCharles Bentley with the O-line or Aeneas Williams with the DBs, once they come up and see it and touch it and feel it, they want to come back. Because you can pack into these 3 or 4 days, you know, everybody that has that coaching itch, and wants to be back in that locker room and be back with those guys. The way this event is and the number of alphas that you're able to be around, and, you know, guys that in 2 years are going to be winning Heisman trophies, and the best players in college football and beyond, for the staff that we have, and particularly the coaches, that have all done at the highest level and, are coming back now to give back to these high school guys, they can pack into this 3 and 4 days, all the football that really can satisfy their soul moving forward. So, if they don't have time to be a high school football coach, or they don't want that grind of, you know, coaching college football and recruiting, and, you know, you know it better than anybody. I mean, the taxing of your body and your mind that goes into that, they can access the best of the best here at the opening for 3 or 4 days. And so for them, again, I talk about, it's not work. It's a pleasure, to be around these kids that are the most driven kids and the most talented kids, and so hungry to learn from guys that have, you know, done it at the highest level. It's different. They don't have that access to that at their high school. I mean, some of them might go to the best high school programs in the country and they have great coaches. But you know, if you're an outside linebacker that's going to put his hand on the dirt and get after the passer, you know, to work with Willie McGinnis for 3 days is an unreal experience that you can't get anywhere else. So, from the standpoint of how we've built it, you know, you talked about football heaven. We want it to be first in class from, you know, Nike's product that the kids are going to wear and participate in, to access to coaches, and then just the ability to go out every day on the field and compete against the other best kids in the country. Like, you're going to get better from that, through the competition of it. You might not be the MVP at the opening. That's a pretty tough thing to do, but you're going to be able to compete, learn, and be around the best. So you're going to have the ability to take your game hopefully to the next level and walk away. I think ultimately with all of our events, and I learned this from Andy and always take it with me, we want kids to walk away inspired, to continue to seek out more information, seek out more coaching, walk away inspired about the game that they're playing and everything it can do for them, moving forward. So,
curious, this is the sixth year of the opening. How many players will come this year?
166.
Okay, 166 players. What is something that over the 6 years of, let's just generalize, 166 players per year have come, per se, what is something that surprised you about the student athlete? Like, did you have an expectation and it went completely the other way? Are you blown away with the courtesy that these kids have? Like, what has been like, whoa, when you come home and talk to your wife, like, man, I can't believe it again, these kids did what?
I think every year we're blown away by the kids' willingness and ability to embrace competition. I know for me, when I was in high school, I think I looked at competition as like, man, this guy's good and I'm worried about what he's doing and how do I beat him. I think through this event and through the series of events and the regionals that lead up to the opening, we've really been able to improve the culture of competition, to where these kids don't look at each other as adversaries, but look at each other as, you know, these are going to be their peers moving forward. So they, through social media, they're a lot closer than they used to be. And so they develop tremendous relationships through this event. But they're so open to competing and they're so open to, making new friends. And, you know, this dude's from Pennsylvania, this dude's from California, and we put them on the same team and 2.5 days later, they're best friends and they're staying in touch with each other as they move through college and that sort of stuff. So, it's awesome because, again, you know, being 17 isn't easy. Being 18 is probably even harder. But they come out and they really open up and give us their soul for these 3 or 4 days and they walk away with so much more because they are willing to embrace the competition and embrace the, you know, these are the best of the best. They got 40 offers. They don't need to do anything at this point. They could sit at home and be like, hey, I'm going to Notre Dame. You know, I'm good. But this culture of competition that we've kind of helped create, I think is they're still striving to get better and see this as a great opportunity to continue to move their game up and not be that guy that's sitting at home while 165, 166 other guys are taking advantage of this great opportunity. So,
you know, we talked to Alexis Jones on this podcast. She's part of the Elite 11 documentary. She's got this foundation about really going around and talking to student athletes in college about stopping violence against women, sexual violence, other types of violence, verbal, etc. Athletes get a bad rap. You know, there's documentaries about athletes being bad, and I'm not saying they aren't. But there's also another large number where lives get saved due to sport, due to scholarships, due to the development and evolvement of being on a team, as you referenced. What do you think a common, just a general, smart, intelligent person who gets sports, maybe isn't a super fan, what do you think they don't know about the process of a student athlete and what sports do for them? Because you get to watch them, Brian, from 16, as we've talked about, but also you get the call from the Jamarcus Russells when they flame out, and I'm not taking a shot at him, but when their careers are over and they get thrown to the side and nobody cares about them, they call you at times because you're the first guy they talk to. So you can offer, I think, almost the purest 360-degree perspective.
I would speculate that the general sports fan or person in general population that wasn't a scholarship athlete in college or that sort of stuff, but follows the sports, they probably don't realize, the amount of work that these kids have had to put in to get to this point. You know, they just see the 6'5", you know, 280-pound Jadeveon Clowney finished product on the field, who's the first pick in the draft, and man, that guy's a freak. You know, he probably rolled out of bed like that when he was 8 years old and has always been the best. And I think the work that these kids have to put in to get to this level, you know, because going through high school, you can kind of coast, but if you're going to be a great player in college, you really are putting in work and committed to it, and it's your craft and your profession. So the work that they put in, and then also the people side of it. You know, these kids, even if they are 6'5", 280, they still go through the same thing that every other teenager does with, you know, self-awareness and social issues and dealing with friends and dealing with girls and trying to excel in school. So all the other things that a normal teenager has on their plate, these kids have it plus more. You know, they have followers on social media, whether they want it or not, because of their status now as an athlete. So they're put in a pressure cooker, so to speak, that not too many other teenagers have to deal with. So when a kid goes, you know, and makes a mistake or gets in trouble off the field, I think I might have a little different perspective from the standpoint that these kids have so much on their plate and there's so many pressures, whether external or internal. It's a really hard position to understand unless you've actually been in it or been around it. And the compassion standpoint for me is, and I probably look at it like, I wish kids did get a second or third chance in a lot of cases, because they're dealing with so much, and it's really, a lot of times they're not in a system or a situation where they're really coached up on how to deal with it and how to handle stuff. So that's probably the, I guess, to summarize the stuff that I see that probably people don't necessarily understand and contemplate when they see a guy get arrested and they just go on Twitter and call him a thug or call him an idiot or whatever.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to note that, and that's what I love about what we do at the Elite 11 and the opening, is educating these student athletes, because they're taught to compete, they're taught to dominate in all areas of their lives at times, because it's not categorized as, okay, you don't do this with women, you don't do this with you know, outside of the football field, outside of the locker room, outside of the weight room. And for every one of those guys that are arrested, there's 100 other guys that are killing it, that went from a non-qualifier to honor roll. So on that note, when you talk about the opening, you say what you hope these student athletes do when they walk away is they get inspired. What are you most proud of when you see a student athlete a couple years later? Okay, they walk away and you get the great email after the opening, July 11th every year. But what 2 years later, 4 years later when Jared Goff's the number one draft pick, 8 years later when somebody makes their first Pro Bowl, 12 years later when they're nominated in the Hall of Fame, what really, if there's an antidote, has inspired you? Because you and your team create this inspirational event. They all walk out inspired, have been there for 8 years. Where do you get impacted? And if you can give us a story around that.
Yeah, I think the short answer is, you know, when you see guys, you mentioned Goff walking across the stage or Tim Tebow winning the Heisman or experiences like that where kids have realized dreams, and you know that whether it's 1% of their journey or 5% or 50%, you've been a part of that. That's certainly something that validates, I think, internally what you do and makes you fired up to wake up the next day and go back and, hey, let's find the next guy that we can help change and get towards his destination. Anecdotally, shoot, that's a good one. you know, I had a kid at the opening last year that, and I won't say his name, just to protect the innocent, I guess. But there was a situation at the hotel and a couple guys were doing something that they shouldn't have been. He was on the perimeter of it. I wasn't there. But when our staff came back in and kind of implicated a couple names of these are kids we need to pull down and talk to and make sure they're doing the right stuff the rest of the way and that sort of stuff. He was on the perimeter and he didn't necessarily understand why he was being included in this group. I didn't do anything. I just was there. So for me, I looked at it as an opportunity to provide him with a life lesson, because when he gets to college or wherever he goes after that, NFL, you got to remember, as a football player, 95% of the time, you're going to be the biggest, strongest, most intimidating person that's going to stand out in any crowd. So if you're ever around anything, you're not going to get the benefit of the doubt. So whether or not you were involved in this, I'm going to take this as an opportunity to give you a life lesson, as it relates to the discipline that we're going to go through and all that sort of stuff. But when you get to college, you're going to be in the same situation, whether it's in the dorm room and guys are doing something dumb like shooting BB guns, or there's a situation with a girl in a room, you're going to be in this situation. I guarantee it, because I've been on a football team and I know how things work in college. So when something happens in college and police are involved or whatever, they're not going to show up and be like, oh, well, you're just standing there, you're fine. That's not how it works. So use this moving forward and realize the situations that you put yourself in. You're not in the general population anymore, whether you like it or not, whether you felt like you signed up for it or not. As a football player or as an athlete in general, you have a much more focused and tighter vision and microscope on everything you do. So use this to realize the situations that you put yourself in. As much as you want to be one of the guys, you just can't be if you want to continue this journey and be successful. If you don't really care, and you know, football is not, you know, something you see as you know, you're just good at it, but you don't really care about using it as a tool, then hey, you know, do what you got to do. I mean, that's a different story. But I think the opportunities to connect with kids through the events and do things like that and hopefully help them along. And he's been a great kid since, and stay in touch, and excited to see how he progresses. But opportunities to connect with kids like that is probably something that we're never going to tweet about or that sort of stuff. But it is certainly self-validating, at least for me, in terms of what we do and the things that we interact with kids on each and every year and days at camp. So,
yeah, you know, one of my favorite things about being involved in this process is in the fall when I go around as an analyst in college football, not only seeing the starter, right, and calling Jared's games or whatever it may be, but also being around the backups. So the guys that were elite 11s coming out of high school, Jake Rodriguez is a great example, goes to Oregon, may or may not have been the right decision for his skill set, doesn't play there, but being able to still connect to those kids where they aren't the dudes. And I think that is when they hit us up, and you know, we do it all the time, where they'll call us for life advice. They're not asking us how to read cover two. They got great coaches, but it's, hey, I want to travel. How does that happen? Or, hey, I'm thinking about going to grad school. Like, what do you think I should study? Or can I do an internship at student sports? And I think that's the fun part of the beyond the X's and O's that doesn't get talked about a lot.
Absolutely. And I mean, the stuff that we're seeing now, too, with our events is we have guys that, particularly with Elite 11, were Elite 11 guys in high school, and now they're progressed through their career and they're old enough and wise enough and they're starting to join the coaching staff. So obviously Jordan Palmer's the primary example, and being around it with Carson coming through as a counselor and then being a counselor himself, and now doing his own private business thing after his playing career is done, but still wanting to come out and help out. And Paul Troth's been on the staff a couple of years. He was one of the first years of Elite 11. And this year getting more guys involved, like a Jake Heaps, who was out at a couple of the regionals, and he was the Elite 11 MVP when he was in high school and going to camp with the Seahawks this year. So football might still be happening for him, obviously, but guys that want to come back and be a part of it. That's where I think we're just going to continue to improve the experience, because these guys, we have a lot of great coaches, but these guys now also have personal stories. They've been through the exact same process with these guys in terms of being recruited and being in a quote unquote Elite 11 guy. So when you get to campus, you might have a little more target on your back and that sort of stuff, and expectations that come along out of it. So seeing that cycle of guys coming through, and I guess it says how old I'm getting and been on this job for a while, but guys that have been coming through in high school and now they're coming back to coach is a really, really cool part of it. Absolutely.
All right. So last couple, we'll get you out of here. A lot of parents are going to listen to this podcast. You know, you get hit up by a lot of parents. You also, while you don't do a lot in terms of you being on the internet, you are out there and outspoken about advocating multi-sport athletes. You've been around the quarterback position as much as anybody in terms of the development of when I am on one track and one lane and this is all I'm focused on. We've seen guys become the number one draft pick. We've also seen guys who play multiple sports and get drafted in the first round and win Heisman trophies. So give the pitch to a parent or to a coach or to a private coach of why you're on this pedestal of advocating for multi-sport athletes.
I think for me, I've seen both sides of it, but I want to see guys that know how to compete and handle moments. I know from my personal experience, but also just guys that we've evaluated over the years and seen, and you know, whether it's Jared Goff, who also was a great baseball player, or Matthew Stafford, who caught for Clayton Kershaw in high school. You're in so many more competitive situations where you're able to test your mettle and your makeup and your leadership abilities and all those type of things, adversity. If you are playing other sports, you can only create so many competitive situations if you're just doing football workouts in the off season. So as much as we want to get out there and tell them that they're in the half skeleton showcase or the finals of whatever at a regional camp, it's not the same as, you know, shooting two free throws when you're down by one with 4 seconds left. It's just a different deal. So love the cross training aspect of being a multi-sport athlete. But I've also seen guys that just, you know, freshman year or seventh grade, I'm going to focus on football. I'm going to be with a trainer all off season. I've seen those kids burn out a lot of times to where football just isn't fun for them anymore. Irrespective or irregardless of how talented they may be, they've almost reached their maximum ability to handle any more football. And it's just, they miss out on other experiences that then they tend to try and seek out later on in life. You know, whether it's a Jimmy Clausen or a Matt Leinart or other guys that didn't even reach the level that those guys reached. I mean, those guys were great players in college football and played in the NFL for a long time. So obviously they did really great things in football. But kids that they just get burned out, and, you know, some guys don't love it, which is fine. And at the end of the day, Trent mentions it in the great, you know, docu that you got coming out next week. You got to love it to make it. So I think when you are able to still have other interests, it creates a more well-balanced kid that when it's time for football, they still have that love and still have that passion. And it's got to be for them. It can't be for mom or for dad. It's got to be for the kid. So if the kid loves playing basketball or wants to play baseball still, that's a good thing, I think, coming through high school. And there's going to be a point, you know, when you get to college where you're probably going to have to shut it down unless you're Russell Wilson or a couple of really unique guys that can still do that through college. But embrace competition, embrace opportunities to test yourself. And those are just, there's so many more of those if you're still doing other sports as you come up through your younger years in high school and heading into your senior year. So that would be my pitch.
Hey, I'm on the train. I mean, I think the better athletes are the ones that understand spacing, and you learn that through basketball. You know, because of up-tempo offenses, you're not necessarily understanding triangle reads anymore as much as you were back in the day when we were playing. I mean, there's so many different areas where multi-sports help. I think a huge area of conversation in the National Football League, all the way down to Pop Warner. I didn't start playing football until I was in eighth grade, but I was always thought I could ball out on the playground, you know, and would. And the reason I didn't play until then, because I was like, man, I'm better than the kids that are playing. Why do I need to play now? Because you'd smoke them in the playground. What do you think about the sport, the state of it? Obviously, people reference concussions all the time. So I know you guys have talked to student-athletes extensively about why they think players participating in high school footballs, that number is dropping at a rapid rate. What's your perspective on that discussion?
It's a great topic. I'm probably more similar to you, where obviously I didn't play a ton of high school football. I played my last 3 years of junior high school, but I follow the sport. I love the sport. I think there's a lot of kids that love following football, even now with fantasy football. And there's guys in, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth grade teams that have fantasy football teams, and they're following the NFL passionately through that. For me personally, and I see a lot of this going around now too, I think there's a development side of the game where if we have a deeper and stronger, whether it's flag football or another non-padded version of it, that at least is up through sixth, seventh, eighth grade, where kids are able to play all positions, you're going to cultivate more love for the game. They're going to have more fun doing it. The thing that we see when we survey kids and talk to kids, they have more options now, in terms of other sports they can play, but also socially. Like, playing sports used to be a huge social thing, and now social media and chat and all that sort of stuff, Skype, whatever, you can have friends, you know, in different states that are your best friends when you're in high school. So the social component is different. And now you got to talk about, how is football fun? So if you go out for football in fifth grade and you're in pads and you have a person coaching you that might or might not be trained and a great person to introduce somebody to football, and they stick you at right guard and you never get to touch the ball, and your experience is, you know, doing up downs and pushing a sled, how fun is that? So think about ways at the youth level where, you know, whether it's flag and kids are rotating around and able to play every position and experience it and have a really fun first experience with it. I think that's one thing. And then how we take the coaching to the next level in terms of the people that introduce kids to football when they go out for a practice. How do you, again, you make it fun? They have more options now. So if you want a lot of people to still play the game, you got to think about how you make it fun. There's going to be people in passionate football hotbeds that football is life, and that's the community they grow up in. But, you know, in different communities, you got to think about, A, how are you going to introduce the kids to the sport, and how do you make it fun? Because the hit a kid on the head with your whistle, grab their face mask, yell and scream at them, 2 hours of Oklahoma drill, those days are gone. Those kids are going to quit and go snowboarding or go play lacrosse or do whatever. So you really have to think about how kids are introduced to football, because it's a great sport, and we both talked about it, how much you can learn through being on a team and testing yourself and standing next to your brothers in the locker room and on the field, and you can learn so much from it. But you have to get kids to that point where they can fight through that and want to be on the team and stay on the team and cross that bridge. So we really have to talk about how kids are entered into the game and the sport and introduced to it, and making it a great experience for them.
I love it. This has been awesome. All right, last couple things, we'll get you out of here. I kind of throw a word out, and then I want your instant reaction. These are short, little, quick responses. When you hear the word pressure, because you're around it a lot, what's one of your early thoughts?
Got to be able to handle it, I guess, is the thought around pressure. If you can't, you're going to be, you know, heading the other direction and not able to pass these challenges and move forward with the next thing in your life. So you gotta find a way to cope and deal and then hopefully excel when you encounter something that you gauge and feel as pressure.
We talked about you in a photographic memory all the way up to now being the president of student sports with all these amazing events. Love to know what makes you feel the most alive.
That's a good one. I think something, you know, you walk out on the field at, whether it's the opening or a regional camp, and you see kids energized and you see them getting ready to go. They've had this moment built up in their mind, and it's something that we've kind of created in this space to give them energy in the off season and give them something to point and aim towards. So when you walk out and you see kids realizing this moment and the excitement that they put towards it, it's a really cool feeling because you know that you're impacting these kids and helping them move forward and stay motivated and driven to succeed in something, which, you know, for a teenager, you know, having something to get fired up about and get excited about and work towards is a great goal to accomplish, you know, day one. So that's, you know, you walk out on the field at the opening and you see 166 kids, you know, the best kids, they're probably the coolest kids at their high school, you know, nothing impacts them and you see them excited. That's a really cool thing for me.
We've asked every guest on this podcast this question, and I think that everybody has a flame, right? An internal flame. It's kind of like that campfire that when it's roaring, you're leaning in, you're warming your hands up. And when it's low, you got to add a new log. You got to flip it over. If you were to get outside of your body now and look at you, how would you describe your flame?
Yeah, I think for me, it's changed in the last 5 years, where my whole flame before was the kids and my job and making my events better. And now that I have my own family, I want to provide and provide a great life for my kids and set them up to be as successful as they can. So love my job still, but I have even more added motivation now. It burns to create a better family life for my family, whether it's, you know, paying for kids' school or shoot, we need to add on to our house because the bedroom's getting tight or whatever it might be. You know, camp in the summer that costs a lot of money, but it's a really cool experience for Connor to get to. So I want to kick butt at my job even more now because I know that I have three people dependent on me to provide and, you know, give them a better life. So that adds to it. I love the kids that come to our events, but obviously my family is near and dear to my heart. So to continue to do what I do and excel at it, just that incentive to set my kids up with everything I can is something that definitely burns inside me. So
I love that. And then finally, B, what do you think about the word limits?
Limits. That's a bad word, man. We shouldn't have limits. You know, driving back here, I want to get back to the office, so I might bust that speed limit on the 405. But no, limits, I think, are something that, you know, people might put on their situation or themselves or other people put on other people, maybe to protect them, I guess. It applies to my speed limit analogy, I guess. but, you know, if you have limits, you're going to have a ceiling as to what you can do and accomplish. So, you know, love the title of your podcast. It makes total sense to me. And having limits to protect people, I get it. But at the same time, if you operate with them and see a stopping point as it relates to something you want to do, that's a bad thing for me.
So how can people stay in touch with you, B?
I'm not hard to find. I'll throw out my email just because it's already out there. And it's just my first name, Brian, BRIAN at Student Sports on Twitter, Stumpf, my last name, STUMPF as in Frank _ Brian. The Snap is new. It's taken off. If you want to see pictures of the kids with the strawberry face and all that sort of stuff and the dog tongue, that's going on Instagram, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, probably Twitter and email is best, and you can spin off on all the other sort of stuff. But yeah, happy to help and interact with people. And, you know, we're like anybody else. We're always looking to add new things to the events and make them better. I know you got a lot of really cool people that work in different walks of life listening to this. So yeah, if anybody has interest in anything we do, love to hear from them. So
I love it. Well, this has been awesome, man. I know we've been planning for a while, and to hear your story, I never knew the breadth of it. I knew there was a lot of depth, but didn't know the intricacies. So thanks for sharing, man. That was rad.
No, absolutely. It was great. A lot of the stuff I probably haven't talked about in 15 or 20 years or ever, maybe. So it was a really cool way to open up and think about things that I probably haven't thought about for a long time. So it was really, really cool for me to do.
Yeah, it was really cool for me to have that conversation as well with Brian Stumpf, an awesome guest on the Life Without Limits podcast. And what I think is a really cool takeaway from Brian is that he's a guy who had a general vision, right? He wanted to be around athletics. He had, as he said in his words, there's always been a desire to compete, but didn't really know where that energy should go, but just kept trying and kept swinging and taking chances and found a really unique niche. And look, we said it in the conversation, being around guys in the NFL and in college football, I think Brian is as smart of a personnel guy and evaluator as I've seen in the entire country at any level. If he wanted to, Brian's on his way to be a GM in the National Football League. Just a brilliant guy, obviously ridiculous mind. How many of us wish we had a photographic memory? I know I do. But anyway, hope you enjoyed it. Hope you also get a chance to follow the Elite 11 documentary on Bleacher Report starting July 1st, as well as the opening and the chase for the Elite 11 MVP, which starts July 5th on the Nike campus. You can follow the Elite 11 on Twitter, as well as the opening. It is going to be an epic week of competition. It always is a blast. It's always a blast to go on this podcast. I really appreciate the love. Check us out on iTunes. Check us out on Overcast now, Blog Talk Radio. Review, rate, share, all that good stuff. It really does help us keep moving as we just got on the new and noteworthy list on iTunes. So we always like to end this thing with a challenge. And I say the challenge is to find out what you love and find out where you want to compete, just like Brian Stumpf. And like we always do on this podcast, we ended the same way. The only limits that we have in life are the ones we set ourselves. Peace.